This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth thinking about. We're talking about and thinking because you think before you speak. I always do this, Rebecca.
I mean,
you
know, ideally.
I never say things off the cuff. Ideally. I kind of think while I'm speaking, honestly, about what's Same. New, cool, and we're talking about in the world of books and reading. I think that's why we enjoy this show. Why I always like the seminar, because you could sort of think of it as you said it.
Podcasting.
Today
for verbal processors.
It's Thursday, October 6, 2022. It's Nobel Prize Day, Rebecca Shinsky.
Woo-woo!
And as always, the prize winner is someone with whom we were intimately familiar, completely know the complete corpus of, and are ready to talk in minute detail to our legion of listeners about why they should too, should make the new Nobel Prize winner a core part. Of their personal canon.
That answered my first question about the Nobel Prize this year, which was going to be...
Let's do a sponsor break before we get into it, because it's the big news story. And if you've been listening at all, you can hear the facetiousness. I don't think that's a word. Facetiousity? Facetiousness, I guess.
Let's go with it.
The face dripping. We'll come right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I also get to pronounce French on a pod, which is always a good look for me. I always do it exactly right. I think this is Annie Ernaux.
Let's go with that.
Ernaux, a French writer. She's 82 years old, has a long history, you're not winning the Nobel as a 41-year-old. That's a young person to me now. That's how old I am. But it's a Nobel Prize winner, Rebecca. The only the 17th woman to win it. So this is still notable, sadly, that a woman wins. I have actually heard of her book, The Years, which was it came out in 2008 in French. I didn't read it in French because I don't read French, and then made it into an English translation 2 years ago. So it kind of tells you about her English language profile, is that her magnum opus had an 11 year lag between the French edition, and the English edition. I heard of that book. It was a finalist for the International Booker Prize in 2019, which is a list I'm always super interested in. That's I got feedback to get to in a minute, but that's one that's one list that I look to for discovery. Like what's going on in the world of international literature? So I had it on there. I kind of knew the name, didn't know much about it. Have you done your Wikipedia reading yet this morning? Chip in like you know anything about this? Yeah, that's where I'm too.
Yeah. I know that one of the books, and maybe it's the same one, features like really straightforward exploration of having had an abortion in the 60s and a passionate love affair. Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, I'm interested in this woman's life.
She's a fiction writer turned autobiographer. So, I mean, if you're a French person that does stuff like this, it's like auto fiction, you immediately get Proustized, like the Lady Proust. That's, you know, you see that, or the female Proust. I don't know if that's fair or not. That's just what I'm seeing out there. But there's a lot of books. The Years really charts a whole, like kind of in one sweep, post-World War II to the 2000s. I went to go try to order The Years like as soon as I saw this morning. I thought I could get in before the rush. I think I was in before the rush, but there ain't no copies out there. There's not something that's wildly in print. You know, you're not going to find this right now. Seven Stories Press, which is her, I don't know if it's all English language text, but certainly her American publisher, as Running Back to Press. She has a new book coming out from Oxford Unity Press and University Press in 2 days, which is about the box store, like the spectacle of the big box store. I also got a frantic email. This is real insider baseball from Barnard College this morning. I'm still on the old listservs from Columbia and Barnard from my days there. And they had the great fortune of having booked Annie Arnault for an event on Friday.
In their
little lecture hall. So I think that's going to be a hot ticket. They're probably looking around for another venue
guess. That's great.
So good job, yeah. Barnard, calling your shot right there. I don't know if anyone thought that was a possibility.
Yeah, I saw on Instagram that Stephanie Anderson, who is a friend of Book Riot and a librarian with the Brooklyn Public Library, was saying something that, you know, she's always interested in using like library holds as a measure for which prizes people actually care about. Mm. And that the number of holds that she was seeing from folks in Brooklyn trying to get a hold of an Annie Arnault book indicated to her that there's a lot of interest for this one.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to pick up The Years when I can find one.
Me too.
I would like to have a print copy of this. I don't know how long it is. That's the other thing that terrifies me when I see Proust. I don't know if you've checked out the shelf that is Remembrance of Things Past. You know, it's tough when Swan's Way is the easy one. It's like 2 800-page volumes.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly when, but seems like an interesting person. I don't know. Now you know as much as we know, listeners, about the 2022 Nobel Prize winner.
I don't know if we're in just a little stretch here of Nobel winners that are particularly interesting to me, or if I'm like aging into some space where the Nobel is going to start serving as more of a discovery tool for me than it has in the past. But I had such a good time with Louise Glück, as we all know.
Yes.
That I'm definitely going to be reading Annie Arnault. I'm very interested based on what I've read about her. And we'll see. We will just see how it continues to go. I did buy the Olga Tokarczuk book last year, but I haven't gotten to it yet. So
which
it's like
one?
Half discovery.
Bones and
Drive
Plows
Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, something like that.
That one. I can never keep that one straight. The Book of Jacob that came out this year in hardcover, I've been eyeing that one. That also is a svelte 947 pages in hardback.
I don't know if I have that
yikes.
In me.
Yikes. But the Bones and Plow one, I think, is kind of the one people are going to because it's digestible. Like, you know, you can hold it in one hand, kind of a deal. If you've read Annie Arnault or have heard or seen other interesting links or commentary, shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Maybe a future Book Riot Patreon bonus episode. Nice time to shout that out. In the feed right now, you've got a list of our favorite campus air quote novels.
I went with campus stories. What even
stories,
is a campus
literary
story?
Documents, texts, indices. That's in the feed now. And we're recording after our regular show today, How We Organize Our Reading Lives, which will be a super extensive and detailed show because both you and I are basically archivists and annotators extraordinaire when it comes to keeping track of our reading lives. So it's going to be a super detailed, minutia-driven, really ecstatic look at how carefully we track our reading lives. So look forward to that.
You are like,
boy,
on the
sarcasm.
The
I don't know
today.
What is going on. I
turned
it on
either,
and the faucet
like,
won't turn off. It's stuck.
It's really there. It was a listener request. They want to know. So, you know, give the people what they want.
It'll be an exciting 7 minutes for them. I hope they're excited for it. All right. Let me do some listener feedback. It's been you were out on vacation. We had Dead Poets last week. So it's been a couple weeks from our regular show. I do want to say thank you. So many people wrote in. They left the comments on the Patreon page, but also emails as a response to my National Book Award long list driven existential crisis. The kind of the tone was what you might expect, which it's fine. You're okay. We like what you do. That's why we're listening to the show. You know, don't worry too much about yourself. What I really wanted was the knives to be sharpened for the National Book Award selection process. That's not what people said. A couple people thought that, well, do you think it's because of, you know, social media and people are doing different books that you know? It's like, that could be the case, except the jury here is like five older writers. I don't know that, like, who was it? Karen Thompson Walker? There's someone we know that would, like,
Pam Houston's on the committee this
Pam
year.
Pam Houston. Yeah. They share a spot in my brain. I don't know if that's fair or not, but
that's
I like them both.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm not too wrong. I'm mostly wrong. But anyway, it's like, I don't think, and then the other names, but I'm not, they're not like 26-year-old influencers or even people working the social for their library, which is an important thing to do. But I just don't think those the people being selected right now as this jury are picking out of that pool. And in a way, I'd be thrilled that there is a mainstream and I'm just not part of it, because then I could go jump into that pool. But I don't think that's what's happening, unless you think I'm wrong, Rebecca.
No, I don't think you're wrong there. I think as I've thought about it more and looked specifically at the judges and this year's books, the place I really landed was these are folks who are in like pretty niche communities of literature already.
Yeah.
Most of them teach in MFA programs. The way that they approach literature and what they're looking for as good and to hold up, maybe the motivation of picking something to hold up, is pretty different from flagging a thing as mainstream applicable. Like what you get in an MFA program, especially with a pretty niche group of writers, is not mainstream fiction most of the time. And that's not what they're trying to do. That's totally fine. But the more I looked at the judges, the more I was like, okay, this makes a little bit more sense to me. And I've read a couple of them. One of the ones I read made it onto the short list. I don't have any thoughts about the other four because I haven't read them, but I'm sure they're all great. But just a really different list than I was expecting to see. I don't think I was quite as shooketh as you were, but we were collectively on that little rocky space.
Well, the difference was I was actively trying to read to, my reading net was to catch these kind of fish, and I got tires and old shoes when it came right down to it. So, I mean, and a lot of people said that they look for this as, they use this as discovery. So they're kind of used to not knowing them. And that's exciting because it's pointing, they're being point to, they're using this as discovery, right? These are unknown things.
There's
you're not going
to
hear about it. You're not, it's that, and that's cool. But so we're coming at it from different points of view, and that's fine. But, they also don't host a podcast professionally and work in books. So I think the stakes are a little bit lower about trying to figure out if your divining rod or your intuition or even your taste is anywhere close to representative of literally anything.
Yeah. Let's not analyze what our taste means today. I don't think we have enough time.
No, we don't. That'll be our Swan's Way Proustian length Patreon episode. You
know, before we get to news of the week, we need to shout out that Book Riot has something to promote ourselves. We have a new book coming out that actually is out by the time you're listening to this, called Reading the Stars, that is astrological stuff for book nerds, or book nerd stuff for astrology nerds. Either way, how it connects how your zodiac sign shapes your reading life, or how you might use it to shape your reading life. You know, like if you're like me and you're a Sagittarius who always wants to be traveling somewhere else, what books might you read? What books might you read for like developing some of the weaker areas of your personality, or the opportunities, as we would call them in the business world? So Reading the Stars has book recommendations that build on your strengths. They explore areas of growth, gives you a like, what does this sign mean? So quick and dirty. Like if you're like me and you're not super astrology fluent, but you want to speak enough of the language to understand what your friend is talking about, where they're like, oh, well, I'm just such a Scorpio. This will do that for you. So whether you know your birth chart by heart or you're just kind of getting curious about it, there's something in Reading the Stars for you. Publishers Weekly called it an ideal gift for bookworms with a celestial bent. And I think that's right on. So especially as we're going into holiday.
Look at that little drop. There. Look at that little shout drop you just did.
That was nice. Shine my little halo.
Yeah, you did.
So especially I think as we're going into the holiday season and gift giving, if you're looking for a gift for somebody who's into astrology and likes books, Reading the Stars is a great pick. It's beautifully illustrated.
It's really
we had such a great time partnering with Abrams on it and worked with a wonderful illustrator, just creative and fun. And through October 31st, you can enter to win a copy along with a bundle of goods from our friends at Obvious State, including a celestial print, a notebook, and a tote bag. And they're the folks who do like just gorgeous illustrations from literary quotes and all kinds of things. So there'll be a link in the show notes where you can enter the giveaway and you can find your way to just purchasing a copy of Reading the Stars for yourself or the astrology book nerds in your life.
One more follow-up that I think is a continuing story, at least insofar as we consider a story in our little niche of the universe, is about the sales of I'm Glad My Mom Died in Babel. Had several people
write in,
librarians, booksellers, giving their little anecdotes. Jamie, who helps us do TBR, also was saying that at the warehouses we use to fulfill TBR, can't get one for love of money to babble. So this is from Mariah, affirmative consent. Thank you, Mariah. I also want to read the most Midwestern humble brag. It's not, this is not humble brag because it's Midwestern. You'll hear what I'm saying here in a minute.
Okay.
I thought I would write in about some anecdote I have as an employee at a parentheses relatively high performing indie bookstore in the Midwest. Mariah, I bet your store is great. I bet it's high performing. Just tell it me like me this. Congratulations. I like to see that. But I like the modesty.
Good job.
Well, I see you. I know what you're doing. I think what she's not trying to say like we're awesome. She's trying to say, I think we move enough units that we're probably data is useful from just our own experience here. She said, Babel's her favorite book of the year, and she's read 150. Mm. That gets me interested. Thank you very much for that specificity, Mariah. Thank you so much for that. Their store got 10 copies on release day and not one since. That is crazy.
That's bananas.
So I don't know what that's about. I went down some rabbit hole the other day. I think Kwang's Instagram got algorithmically fed to me because maybe I said babble aloud loud and Skynet heard me. So the algorithm. And I was like, I saw her, I was like, is she talking about this? Is she noticing that you can't get it? And one thing I saw there, and this is complete supposition, don't quote me, this is not past journalistic standards of any kind, is that it looks like there's a whole bunch of special editions for like different book boxes, like some fantasy boxes. And I'm wondering if some of them are going towards that. There's a bunch of special editions. Clearly, they just screwed up the number of copies to print. Something went haywire here.
It sounds like they just really underestimated how the book was going to perform.
Yeah. And then in terms of I'm Glad My Mom Died, the McCurdy book, they continue to get copies, but they sell very quickly. Mm. Did I tell you about my visit to the new Barnes & Noble format store here in Oregon? I think that's
not
why we're gone. Should we do this for a few minutes?
Yes.
Let's
obviously
do a sponsor
I
break.
Know
I've got
about
thoughts.
This.
I'm sorry. This was going to be a whole segment. I was going to put it in here. I totally forgot. I've got no notes off the cuff as opposed
it's our
to
show,
my
man.
Studied and stayed, recitation that I normally do. Let me do a sponsor break. We'll come back and get into it. Did I do the sponsor break? I don't know. We'll edit it. We'll find out. Good job, me. I hope you figured that out in the future when I'm editing this in 3 hours. That was great. Did myself no favors. Let's see. I was talking about Babylon. I'm glad my mom died. Where my mom died. I'm sure that's included.
My mom died in Babel?
What, where, if, and how, and how glad I am that my mom died. We were out at the Barnes & Noble that's west of Portland in an affluent suburb, and it's one of these, the big new format stores. I hadn't been in a big new format Barnes & Noble. I'd seen pictures, heard about it. So a couple of things. The reason I thought about there is because out on the front table, they had an arrangement of I'm Glad My Mom Died. So they clearly either just got them in or maybe it's not selling as well there for some reason. But they didn't go put them like on the shelves or even on one of the display tables. It was like by the register. So I'm thinking these are going to, I should have asked. I'm such a coward in public when it comes to talking to people. I don't want to bother anybody. Anyway, I should have just asked. Anyway, but I looked around for Babel. No Babel scene. I went on the shelves in science fiction fantasy. Nothing there. So I think that does show a little bit of what Mariah is talking about here. It's like the McCurdy is selling, but there are copies and they're coming out. The Babel, Lord knows what's happening.
Nowhere
right
to be
there.
Found.
Really, really concerning. It's a real shame, too, because it sounds like a really interesting book. It is kind of the thing we've been talking about as maybe being the center. You know, I can't find the center with the jackhammer right now of literary culture, but like genre, literary, social commentary, diverse voices, the whole thing. She's an academic as well, which is another story, another. So it's a shame they can't get the copies out, and I'm sure they're trying to print as many as they can. But the bookstore was the real eye-opener to me. So I don't know if you've seen these. Nicole, actually, one of our listeners, emailed pictures from her trip to a Barnes & Noble, and it looks the same one. So it's another reason to talk about here. Thank you, Nicole, for sending those in. So you walk in, and I think the best way to describe it is it feels like a gym in terms of the proportions, like much higher ceilings, more of an industrial, almost like IKEA like singing ceilings.
Okay.
And it's much darker, but it's lit from sort of the sides and below. So it has this feeling, as opposed to the Barnes & Noble, the standard format you and I have talked about, which it feels like you're walking into like an overlit living room, like where all the lights are on all the time.
Yeah.
And it feels there's too much fluorescent and it doesn't feel cozy.
So is this like mood lighting?
Yeah, kind of. It kind of more feels like a high-end retail store where there's lighting, but it's not, the whole thing is lit up. So that's one thing that I noticed right away. You walk right in and the whole front section is just tables arranged paperback favorites or just some collection, Spicy Talk, Reese's Book Club. There's the Oprah picks. There's some other stuff. And so, you know, those are the tables you're used to, but they're spread out much differently. And there's not just one or two of them. There's like 10 of them all before you even get to the register. And then you approach the register, and to the sides and kind of behind the register and the checkout are two curved bookshelves that, you know, you see them right as you come in, and all the books are face out. So it's just covers. And those are new releases right there. And then as you go through, the shelves aren't, it's not like library shelving where it's like row, row, row. There's all these curved shelves and all the books are face out, or a lot of the books are face out, I should say. I didn't go through, but most, it feels like almost all of them are face out. And you can see the other sections and their face out from various points of whatever section you're in. So it really pulls you through because you're like, here's this section. Oh, I want to go see that. I want to go.
Yeah,
and so it kind of really pulls it through. And so the browsing does feel more like you're at a Gap or Banana Republic where you're not going back into the stacks. I guess that's the library shelving term I forgot about. The stacking kind of situation where you're in sort of a catacombs. Everything is open and meant to be browsed and meant to be discovered more than here's the book I'm for and let me go find it in the back of the room. I thought the kids in section was terrible. It's like way back in the corner. I really prefer the old kids section, the older format one. It didn't feel inviting. It didn't feel fun. Maybe they're different for this one, but I think that was the only place I felt like it was a real step backward. Michelle, my partner, who is an architect, hated the space. I think
I was going to ask.
Well, she made the comment that most of the time people don't like to have your back to a huge open space. And there's a lot of places in this where you're going to facing a shelf and you're going to have a lot of open space behind you. Didn't bother me. She didn't care for that. She didn't like the lighting. She thought the tables were too spread out at the beginning. So it felt like you're walking into kind of an empty-ish store. I agree that the tables at front weren't super attractive to me. I think I would just made those shelves, but I think what it was really doing is by having those flat tables, it allowed line of sight like almost all the way to the back of the store so you could see everything. So if you have curved shelves right there, it really blocks everything up. So I think they're solving for this getting pulled through, and it much more makes you want to wander the whole store, which I have to admit, it's not something I've done in a Barnes & Noble old format in a while. I kind of go to Literary Fiction, I'm at the front, and then if I don't want anything else, I'm not go looking around because it's not that fun. But this, you're really browsing through. I thought it was a real improvement. That's my take, a real improvement.
I liked it. That's super interesting. It sounds like a big version of the vibe I like in my favorite indie bookstores, which have the walls lined with big floor-to-ceiling shelves, and then everything else is a shorter display, which does give you something like either a table or some sort of big stand, gives you stuff to walk around and a path through the store. And I had never quite thought about it the way you're articulating it, but it is the book equivalent of like standing at the jeans and being able to see the leather jackets.
That's right.
And that's nice. Right. It's just there's something kind of dopamine-y about it in that shopping experience of like, I'm right here with this thing that I think I might want and I can see this other thing, and that it does pull you through both sort of physically and visually. Sounds really interesting. I wonder if the face outs, like you have less shelf space when you're facing books spining them. And I wonder if that has something to do with the stories that we've been hearing recently about Barnes & Noble decreasing like debut hardcover orders. Like you just have less shelf space if you're going to face
stuff out. I had the same thought. There are manifestly fewer books per square foot shelvable in this format. You just can't because with cover out, you know how volume and spines work. But I think it makes sense. The covers are great. Like a whole wall of cover out books is awesome. It's really beautiful.
So appealing. Yeah.
I would do my own bookshelves that way, but I also have like the practical problem is they're storage as well. And it actually kind of made me think about, is there some other way to do this? Can I have my cake and eat it too, to some degree? It's like, well, do I need all the books? That's a whole separate thing. Talking about psychoanalyzing or discernment, that's one. But like, do I need to be able to see them? Or could like some of them be face out with the spines behind as storage and you can move them around or something like that? But I thought it was a really good store and I think a really good update. And I'd be curious to see what they're seeing in terms of sales change by volume, you know, by square foot of the store. It was a good little jaunt out there. And, you know, they do a really good job too, I have to say. I think even more now of like the sidelines being kind of sprinkled throughout, you know, you're going to go by a table of the bookish puzzles by the one table. It's not like a whole area. It's more like you're going to incidentally see the sidelines as you're browsing the other stuff. So it makes it feel a little bit more like there's the tchotchke corner, right? Or just while you're getting Snickers barred in the checkout line with like scarves and mugs and stuff. It feels a little bit, so it makes the browsing experience, because you can discover like, oh, here, I didn't know they had, you know, bookish hats or whatever else it might have been right there. So that was really interesting. I'm totally off topic, except to say thank you, Mariah, for emailing us. And if you or others that emailed me about us about Babel see a turn of the tide at any point, I'd sure like to hear that, because it is a confounding sales trajectory, because it seems like people, we're talking about it, people really love the book and it's selling. Ain't no books to be found. It's not what you want as a publisher. I'm sure they're gnashing their teeth. They cannot be thrilled about that.
Right. And I'm sure that it's doing okay, like in ebook sales, but there are folks who want a book in print.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's too
right.
bad.
I bought a copy at Powell's. They had two of them a couple weeks ago and I bought one of them. It's a wonderful edition, really quite a lovely edition. So I'm not surprised that it's being especially coveted in physical form. Oh, we got a lot of news. We got to hit this because it was on the agenda a couple weeks ago. People were emailing us about it. Why didn't you talk about this? We saw that audiobooks are now live on Spotify.
Yes, they are.
I'm not sure what else there is to say at this point, Rebecca. Is there anything else interesting about this?
I don't think so. I haven't bought an audiobook on Spotify because folks who remember Justice for Bob will know that we have a backlog of Audible credits in my household. But I went through all the steps except for actually finalizing the buy, and it's annoying in the way that getting an Audible book used to be annoying on an iPhone, where you can search for the book in the Spotify app, and then once you want to make the purchase, you're directed to, you have to go to your browser, and like functionally if you're on an iOS device, you have to move to your computer. You can't do it on your laptop, or you can't do it on your phone. But they're priced according to prices the publisher sets, you know, so same price for the audiobook you're going to find anywhere else. And presumably they can toggle with some sales and do some things, but it's a good catalog. Anything that's available in other places you're looking for audiobooks is basically available in Spotify. I'm finding this appealing for the future, because I do the rest of my audio life in Spotify. Podcasts are there. I've got more than a decade's worth of music over there. I like the idea of fewer apps, since we've had this like decade of app expansion. I might start exploring this when we finally run through the last of the Justice for Bob Audible credits. But good to see. It's good to see. I wonder, but they're probably not going to give us like numbers about how this goes, but I wish that they would. I would like to see it be successful, not just for having, you know, another robust piece of competition in the market, but that it's so nice to just pay the price for the audiobook and not have to screw around with a credit-based subscription.
Yeah, my head's in my
hands.
Please. Yeah, I think this is for people who don't have an audiobook source of choice already. Great. I can get it in Spotify. I think if you're already in Audible or Barnes & Noble or Libro or Kobo, or now I'm just naming audiobook retailers, there's not much real reason to switch, especially if you have a listening flow down like I do with Audible. Like, I know how to use the app. They have the best selection. There's also Audible Originals that I don't know how, maybe some of that moat will come into effect with Audible. Like, why do I keep doing these Audible Originals? Maybe it's because they're worried about stuff like this. There's a reason to keep the subscription rather than just buy the titles, because, you know, quiet as it's kept, title-based buying is a commodity, right? Like we're just saying about Babel. Who's got a copy of Babel? If I'm looking for the copy, unless I'm an unusual kind of buyer, I'm not going to pick one retailer over because of anything other than convenience and price. I hear all you indie bookstore readers. I know, but you're out there. But you and we that think about this, and I do, are weirdos. We're outliers when it comes to this kind of stuff, right?
That's true.
But maybe someone who hasn't tried an audiobook before, I wonder if younger potential listeners who haven't saddled up, maybe don't have as much money, aren't willing to do a subscription for an Audible or something else, like, oh yeah, I'm glad my mom died. I wonder if that kind of surreptitious spur of the moment stuff could be cool.
Yeah.
Surface that. It's like, yeah, you heard of this book? Listen to it right now on Spotify, or buy it right here in Spotify, as opposed to like, how do I buy audiobooks again? Because there's always that step now. It's like, what's the price? It's either $400 or $11.95 a month. Those are your two
choices.
Don't
get us started on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about my dad, who's a diehard Spotify fan, listens to music all day long, and listened to audiobooks. He was in sales for most of his career and did a lot of travel, and listened to audiobooks like the old-fashioned way with the 5 billion cassette tapes and then slightly fewer CDs when those were the formats. And then it fell out of his life. He retired around the time that digital stuff was becoming big. And that's just not been part of his life, even though all the other audio components, listening to music, still is. And I feel like if I were to be like, yo, dad, you can also do audiobooks on Spotify now. You don't have to learn a new app. You don't have to set up an Audible account that has to be managed separately from your Amazon account. Like, you already have this. It's just like two more steps. You can do it. I think that he'd be interested in that as well. So I think some possible expansion for all kinds of folks who, as we know, there's a lot of headroom still in book readership for conversion to audiobooks. There's a lot of opportunity for growth, and having it be inside an ecosystem that so many people are already familiar with, and not like another app that just does one thing. Like, I think I'm thinking a lot about like Alton Brown's kitchen philosophy of like, don't have single tasker items in the kitchen. Like, get a knife that can do a bunch of things. You don't need a special thing that cores apples and a special thing that does something else. Get a knife that does a bunch of things. And Spotify is becoming one of those, you know, multi-purpose tools for all kinds of content in our lives, which I think is just such a smart way to think about it.
Let's say tomorrow Spotify offered a one audiobook credit per month for $12. That's what I have with Audible, just saying that. Do I switch? Would I be like, I'll keep it in one? I don't think I would. I don't know why. It's not that hard. I already have Audible. It's there, you know? I don't see any compelling reason on a feature level. I do kind of like, weirdly, using my garlic press versus my other thing here, because it's not, I don't have to search for where the audiobooks are. Like, you know what I listen to in Audible? I listen to audiobooks. Versus tabs and podcasts and music and everything else. Maybe if the navigation were better, but I don't think for me, Spotify adding audiobooks solves any of my problems right now. Now, pricing, you want to charge me a flat $15 per, buy it in app right there, charge my Spotify account. I'm listening, Swedish overlords at Spotify. Swedish? I think they're Swedes.
Yeah.
You see, we're getting a Spotify origin story docudrama thing with the WeWorks or WeCrash style. We're getting one of those about Spotify.
Interesting.
I don't know if there's any drama spiciness. There. Yeah, I'm sure there must be. Anyway, there's that. I'll tell you something I am excited about and I'm probably going to buy and totally don't need. You know where I'm going with this. It's the Kindle Scribe.
I do know
Scribe.
Where you're going. Tell me about
this
in it.
Today. Had you seen this? This broke where you were away. Had you heard about this at all? Did this flutter?
Yeah.
See, that's the problem. They're not going to sell any of these. So what are we going to do it now?
Except to
me. I don't think I'm enough, Rebecca, for this at least. I'm so much more than
Tell
enough,
me about
in a
the
lot
Kindle Scribe.
So this is on The Verge. There's a story by David Pierce over there who covers. They actually do a pretty good job of covering e-readers, The Verge. Like, if Kobo has a new thing, they'll do a post about, like, wow, that's a deep cut. I don't know how many Verge readers are really interested in that, but whatever. It is a new format. It's called the Kindle Scribe, and it's big. Let me say this. If I was going to pick one new Kindle device format and everything, I would have picked this. It's 10.2 inches, so it's regular, it's normal iPad size. So it's not big, it's not small, it's like the middle iPad size. And it's got a stylus, and it's great, and you can mark on your Kindle books and PDFs, and it'll remember it. Has a front-lit display with a warm light, 300 pixels per inch, so it's going to look really sharp. There's two pens, which, what are you doing? There's a basic pen or a print. Just let me charge me for the pen with ads. I don't know what, this is stupid. There should be one pen. The pen with ads on it. You pick it up and it says,
Well, here's
$10 off your next Lyft ride.
This is the nice you know, option for the people like us who are just waiting to find the right pen and the right notebook, and then all of their problems will be solved.
This will solve all my problems though, Rebecca, because I can
hear it
and remember and save. I can mark up Kindle books, PDFs. I can do all the things. I'll be a product. My reading life, I was already on point keeping track of my reading life. I'm going to go, it's going to be wild stuff here. I'm going to be like knobs and switches and all sorts of stuff.
And ask you in 6 months how you have become a different person thanks to your Kindle Scribe. It looks like Amazon's answer to the Remarkable tablet.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, which we have heard from a couple of people that they use for the kinds of things that we were guessing people use it for.
Lawyers,
like preparing legal documents. Mm-hmm. You're an academic and you've got to mark a thing up. And so maybe Amazon just wants to get on in there. As much as I love to mark things up, and I will buy a hardcover copy of a book that we're going to read together on the show so that I can mark it up and make my notes. I'm not compelled for $340 here. I'm just going to stick with my iPad, my glorious iPad.
What if there was
Mini.
An ultra premium pen, though? Do you think it's because there's not enough pen choices? Do you think that's why you're not choosing?
Does it come with a notebook?
The $30 premium pen, this is amazing stuff, includes a customizable shortcut button and an eraser sensor. I don't know what a customizable... So you press the end of the button, it takes you back to your home screen or starts recording. It's kind of weird to do. Handwritten notes are stored in your Kindle collection along with everything else. One of the biggest knocks against ebook readers has been that they don't support marginalia, the quick notation scribbles that so many bookish types like to leave in their pages. The Scribe brings a lot of that back. This shouldn't work on me. I could buy this, and I will never use it. Do you hear me, future self?
I do.
How do you need to hear this?
You don't need a ghost of future, because you've got me.
I'm all three ghosts and myself. I know. I'm all the ghosts. They're all aware. They're talking to each other right now, but it doesn't matter.
Do you annotate your hard copies of things?
It depends what I'm reading. So we're doing something for work. And I do. Absolutely do.
And
but if I'm
so
reading what's a good example?
So you don't have to become like a totally, you don't have to become a totally different kind of person to use this, theoretically.
No, that's the problem. I just am me all the time. That's the problem here.
Well, I think you'll have a really nice dopamine surge from this at a very fun first week.
No, what's going to happen is I'm going to be like, you don't need to buy this. I'm fine not buying this. I'm totally fine not buying this. And then magically somehow I'll buy it. And for 2 weeks, I'm like, this is great. I'll use it for three things.
Yep,
and then a week after that, I'll be like, what the hell are you doing? You've done this to yourself again. You never get any better. Why do we even learn things and go to therapy? It's just the same old crap over and over again till you die.
It'll give you you'll have a great time in therapy that day. You can take a break from talking about tomatoes.
What if my therapist is using a Kindle Scribe, though, to take notes?
What if you buy your therapist a Kindle Scribe?
You know, I'll have to give it to someone because I won't be flipping using it.
Doesn't your dad listen to the show? Dad, can you just buy this for Jeff for Christmas so he can stop worrying
about it? I don't know if Dad listens anymore. Dad doesn't like Kindles. It'd be a wonderful birthday gift. It is expensive. It's $340. And that's before, I'm not even sure what your pen situation, does that come with your dirty old normie pen? You know, that even come with
not the customizable.
Ultra, not the customizable, you know, ad supported pen.
Oh, it's you're terrible. In good form today.
It's nice, isn't it? Yeah. Well, we're talking about my favorite things. Books being out of print, audiobook pricing, and Kindles
technology
I won't
you're never going to use.
Yeah. That will make not one lick of difference on the number of National Book Award finalists I've read.
And that's the nugget for therapy.
If there were one more Kindle, I would have read 3 of the 10 finalists and would have been a whole and complete person.
Oh, Jeff, at least the therapists are going to be all right. We've got plenty of material.
If you look, there's links in the show notes. Yeah, links in the show notes to the stories here. My favorite thing about this, it would be worth $10 for this illustration of one of their, like, you know, PR marketing shots. There's someone who's drawn a crocodile, like a cartoon crocodile, and is like annotated it, and it says small eyes, and it like points to the bumps, and then it points to the toes. It's small toes, but no flippers. How to swim? I don't know what they're doing here. What is this? Cartoonists need the Kindle Scribe? It's weird.
I think that's what they're going for, because that competes with some of the iPad features for like illustrators. Yeah. But the Kindle Scribe is just black and white, correct?
Yes. And okay. And Pierce even mentions that an e-ink display would have been a game changer. Listener, you might be wondering out there, why not just use your iPad with a pen like a champion? And the answer is, it's a great point. Thank you so much for making it. The
it's second not one new is, and shiny.
No, this is not a good reason. I will use it to rationalize it later. I know that, but I'm saying it now. It's not a good reason. Is that you can mark up Kindle books and it'll remember the annotations, which you cannot do, to my knowledge, simply and easily. But I do this for like 8 books a year where I buy a hardcover because I know I want to mark it up. And I want that hardcover anyway, because here's the thing. It's not just the marking, it's being able to find it quickly. And there's still no equivalent to just flipping through the book and say, where's my star? Where did I dog ear the thing? If you don't do this and this offends you to mark a book, I'm so sorry. I don't know how to mark that in iTunes, that it's not safe for work for people like you. But that's what I do when I'm really using the book as a teaching or learning object. It becomes its own marginalia.
Yeah.
This still doesn't do that. So I know, Rebecca, I know I don't want this.
And yet. Yeah, that's my primary complaint, is that it's hard to go back and find the notes. Like occasionally I will be reading something digitally that I'm like, oh, I'm going to end up referring to this. It's too late now to go get the hard copy. And I'll start making highlights. And I just know then that the best experience I can have at the end of that is to skip through the highlights page in my Amazon app and then try to remember the full context for them and take my notes. And like, that's fine if the thing I'm highlighting, and this is not at all a real example, is the worst lines in a Colleen Hoover ebook.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why you think about that.
Read back to someone later.
Yeah.
But it's not if I'm like trying to remember, oh, what was the explanation here for this particular thing? Or what was that great example? Or what's that beautiful sentence in that Ishiguro? Like, there is not a good digital equivalent of flipping back through a book to find the thing that you were looking for, even though tapping the corner of my iPad takes probably less time than flipping the pages of an actual book does. It's just not the same. Maybe folks who grew up as digital natives have a different experience of it. I really wonder about that. Like, my mind got blown last year when a high school teacher friend was talking to me about like kids having their iPads in class and using laptops and that they don't use lockers anymore. And I was like, but what about the textbooks? And she's like, honey, the textbooks are all on their laptops and their iPads. And I was like, but how?
But you can't learn that way.
Right.
That's not how learns.
That's not how learn happens. Yeah. And so maybe young folks who are younger than we are have a different feeling about accessing their marginalia. But that's my primary holdout too. Aside from, I'm not paying $30 for a magical customizable clicky pen. I don't even want the dirty normie pen.
preview of rationalizations to come. If I'm going to have a Kindle, Rebecca,
you might as well have.
I mean, if I'm going to have one, why not get the one where you get the dirty normie pen? And that is 10. It is a larger format, and I do like the larger format. I've said before about the Oasis. Mm-hmm. I've got larger hands, and it's a little weird to hold in my giant gorilla hands. I'm sure the pen will be finely sized. I'm sure that won't be weird at all to have the little Kindle pen in my other hand. The bigger one is probably the more expensive one. The other one's like one of those little golf pencils. You got to use something like that. I don't know. I'm just making that up. So there's that. There's nothing wrong with my Oasis. Though I wouldn't mind if it broke by the time.
Did you already get the new Oasis? Didn't they? We just talked about it a couple weeks ago.
That wasn't an Oasis. That was the So there is the Kindle. That's what we were talking about. The number one Kindle. That's the Kindle. There's the Paperwhite, which is a step up from the Kindle. No, the new one is the new base Kindle. It's just not as crappy. They changed it so it's not doesn't look fuzzy. There's the Paperwhite, which is
a new one.
Slightly better. I think it has a warming backlight, adjustable backlight. Can't remember. The Oasis is that's the tall cotton one, was the high-end one. Has a nicer screen. It's a metal display, a little bit larger. Has the asymmetric design where one side's got a little chunkster wedge on the side so you can hold it with your hand and you're not... And it's also the Scribe does. And that was, I think the list price for that is like $289 now. So this is even more expensive than that. We've done enough on this, except to say that one of the competitors, they mentioned the Remarkable 2. They say okay. Why you might prefer this to the iPad or the iPad to this, all things we know. But one of the other competitors that's the same size is a $479. And the reason I'm bringing this up is the name of this unit is the Books, B-O-O-X, Note Air 2.
Rolls off the tongue. Which,
I don't know what Don Draper would say about any of that, but it's got the X for the KS. It's no Air 2. That's just too much. It's like I'm buying a Volvo, an XC90L. It's like, what is this? I don't know.
So what's the countdown clock on
I try not to see when this is coming. It's available for pre-order. It'll be out before the holidays.
Okay.
I think if you're Remarkable 2, you're not thrilled with this news.
Probably not.
Okay, well,
that was a journey.
What else do we have to do here? Speaking of Amazon, this is really follow-up from the story we talked about before. Book Talk ruined the Amazon's very generous ebook return policy.
It's why we can't have nice things.
You could read the whole book and say, nope, I'd like my too expensive ebook back, my $14.99 back. And they did the thing. I think it was one of the ameliorations that was suggested, one of the ones we thought was reasonable, is if you've gotten past a certain percentage, and I don't know off the top of my head, my eyes are too drawn to the Kindle Scribe features 10%. And benefits page. I can't. So if you've read more than 10% of the book, you bought the book. Which,
yep, it's yours now.
Okay. Could we quibble? Could we quibble with that 10? Do you have any quibbles with that 10?
No, I think this is totally reasonable.
Yeah.
Like if you visibly read a book that you bought, a physical book that you bought, you can't stroll into a bookstore and just be like, I don't like this.
If it's
in mint condition, sure. But books, you know, get worn or bent or whatever, pretty easily. I don't know if there's been an uptick in that in physical book return attempts. It did not happen very often when I was a bookseller. You can let us know if you're a bookseller and you're listening to this. But I think 10%, 30 pages of a 300-page novel is enough to get a flavor of, am I going to like this or not?
I'm anchored at 50 pages for some reason. Yeah. That's kind of what I do, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's that Nancy Pearl rule of 50. I could see that, but since Kindle doesn't measure things in pages, it measures your progress in terms of the weird locations throughout the ebook or the percent that you've read.
You're on location 798 of 34,789. Super helpful,
right,
Kindle.
You know what's weird is that I now know how long a book is that has 8,000 locations versus 2,500.
Do you think if I press the action button on my premium pen, it could just auto convert that to percent?
That would be
maybe
great.
Could I make that my quick option on my $700 Mont Blanc special edition Kindle Scribe?
That's a pricey price to pay for just that upgrade feature.
Do you know what fountain pens go for?
It's true.
It's wild stuff. So I think this is good. I think this is something that most people didn't know. You could just willy-nilly return stuff and probably should have been the policy from the beginning. Wasn't getting abused enough. And Book Talk ruined it. Called out especially lots of Verge shouts. They still cover tech stuff related to books better than anybody else. No one else does their kind of stuff. So,
and this is a good note maybe for Book Talk or social media in general. Like finding a loophole and telling everyone about it doesn't actually help anything.
No. Maybe for then you're just algo right. for a while, but
then we just can't have nice things. So.
What was I going to ask? I guess the other piece about not bringing the book back to the physical bookstore, is that there is some friction. You got to go to the bookstore.
Right.
Maybe you've even got to say, why did you return it? It's like, you bought the book.
Right. I think most of the
I read 9% of it and didn't like it. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah. The returns I encountered were almost always gifts. And then,
yes.
Those folks had their gift receipts. That's the whole purpose of a gift receipt. And then at the time, Harry Potter and Twilight were both happening. And there would occasionally be parents who my child bought this Harry Potter book and it is of the devil. And I do not wish for them to have it. That kind of thing would happen.
Yeah. Right. Was it 11% of the devil, though? Because if it's less than 10% devil, you can't bring it back.
Like, lady, if he already read it, you can't return that. It's in his brain.
Yeah. If you know, if you've read enough to know it's devil-y, you got to keep that.
11% of the devil is definitely the show title today.
Yeah, 11% of the devil. You know, just enough. Just enough devil. So there's that story. I don't know how many ad spots we've done. I think we've done enough. We're running out of time. Where do you want to go? Do you want to go to Frontlist Foyer, or do you want to do adaptations, or quickly both?
Oh, let's do a little Frontlist Foyer.
Okay, you go first, because I forgot what I was going to talk about. I'll look it up, because my reading life is so organized.
Right. Let's see. And I've been in cold medicine all week, so we've just been wild.
I'm the one that sounds like I've been on cold medicine.
It's a good time here at the Riot. Yeah. I was on vacation. I read Stay True by Wash U on my flight out.
And?
Oh, man, it was so good. And it made me cry on an airplane. And then I was mad at you that you didn't tell me it was going to make me cry.
Well, that's part. Okay, listen, you've already... I don't know how to do this. We're trying to talk to each other through spoiler-filled internet people listening to us.
I know. Actually, I understood why you didn't tell me, because the thing was a pivotal moment. And I was like, God damn it, Jeff. It was wonderful. Just his voice is so wonderful. And I wasn't terribly familiar with his writing. Like when we went into the, you know, Catherine Schultz memoir, I know her voice pretty well. Wash U was much newer for me. And just that, the way that he captured that feeling, like I think you were talking about it on the Campus Stories Patreon episode, of what it's like to go to college and meet people, and that, like, the romance of meeting your friends when you're a young adult. And like, there was a little feeling of like Perks of Being a Wallflower to it, of like driving in the car with the windows down and the music turned up and all those sort of like really special friendship moments, but in a surprising friendship, and really, I thought, intricately examined stuff about race and identity and coming of age. And just, it was really tender in a way that I wasn't quite prepared for, but I was really happy to be surprised by it. It was beautiful. I think that's going to be among my favorites for the year.
So I'm going to lead you to other Frontlist for you. I know you've read, I don't think you've talked about on the show, in the Jeff Was Right category, In the Early Times by Tad Friend. In our New Yorker memoir off, who's got the belt right now? We've got Schultz, we've got Friend, we've got Hua. I guess Patrick Radden Keefe is not a memoirist, but I did the collection of his essay Rogues, which it scratches a different itch, but four wonderful New Yorker books this year. Where are you coming down now?
It's a good question.
It's a tough one. Hate to have to choose. You don't have to, but this way we got to make content here.
Yeah, we got to make content. We got to do the thing. I think for the content, the Tad Friend stuff, like there was that book was fascinating and rang a lot of my personal bells.
The end is a real thing. You were started real texting spicy. You got towards the end. I was like, here we go. I'm like, we're here. Yeah. Let's do it.
Just like what he's writing about and what happened in his family and then what happened with him was, that's just a story. It is a story to have, and then it is a story to tell the world. Like, I got a lot of questions for Tad Friend about how he got permission to tell the world that story.
Seriously,
I think for the...
Right?
Yeah. I want to have a lot of drinks with his wife one day. For the quality of the writing, I think it's neck and neck between Shu and Schultz. For the specialness of the reading experience between them, maybe. Where are you sitting on it?
I'm not really sure. I mean, they're doing different things. I think Schultz is 3 out of 3 for me. Mostly because I think she's using personal experience of losing someone and then entering into a relationship to do sort of a larger literary meditation on losing and finding, which felt like a lot of effort to write a book about losing your dad and falling in love, which is fine, but it was just a lot of filigree around it, which I like the filigree. It's beautifully well-wrought filigree, but it just felt like trying to do too much, it didn't need to do all that for it to be meaningful. Where we break it down with Stay True, and in the early times, I think you're kind of cascading down to closer and closer to the bone. Where Stay True, I feel like, is the least adorned of all of them. Mm-hmm. And even Friend, I remember some of it, like I said on the show, there's some sentence, I think some of the sentence level stuff is very artful,
Yes.
And some of that is what he's doing is processing this through writing. Like writing is it's not just the mode, it is the medium here that he's describing his father's writing and his writing. With Stay True, it just felt like it was very simple. It was very elemental. It was a relatively simple, short. It wasn't a whole life, my dad's whole thing. It's really like a 6-year period, right? From middle of high school to not even the end of college. So it's much more focused. And so it feels more intimate, and it has a certain punchiness that the other ones really don't. And New Yorker writing is not known for punchiness. It's known competent, luxuriating in elocution, which I like that because I just said that phrase, right? You know, you don't say a phrase without liking New Yorker writing. But there was something about the focus and purity of Stay True.
Yeah.
That's just different. I don't know if I like it better or worse, but that is the difference to me from the other ones.
The feeling of Stay True felt so much closer to the surface, which I think you're getting at, that like Schultz especially is both in her stuff in the memoir, but also really at a remove from it. Because it's like, I experienced a loss. Let me talk about the loss. But let us also step back and think about the concept of loss.
And what French poet
the etymology.
Quotation would be useful here. And
right.
That kind of stuff, yeah.
And Shu just stays right in it in a way that it was so absorbing. It was a one sitting, one flight read. I loved it. My other vacation reading was not front list, but was kind of a surprise to me because I talked about On Beauty by Zadie Smith on our Patreon episode. But it had been like a billion years since I read it. And I was like, I got to go back to Zadie Smith. I was such a young person when I first read that. But what is it like going back to this book that is mostly about middle-aged people? And it was... Man, Zadie Smith forever. I feel the way about her as I feel about Ishiguro. If I could have a Zadie Smith novel every year, I'd be such a happy woman. It's so good. It is just so good.
She wrote that when she was like 27, which is so infuriating.
Bonkers. That is just bonkers. Like that she's in the heads of both the academia inner workings and all of the stuff that happens there. And it's sharp and funny and really observant in the ways that you expect Zadie Smith to be, but also sort of deeply into the marriages and families of these people that are middle-aged, and how she at 27 could make sense of all of that and grasp it is just bananas to me. It was I'm so glad I went back. It's making me think about like, do I need some sort of project where I look back at other things I read when I was like in that 22 to 25
we've had a range. Good time every time we've done this interpretive realities. We've had a good time. Everything. Do you want to go back to Lonesome Dove? I mean, we did the 12 part show. I mean, is it too soon to
Lonesome
go back?
Dove, so we gotta go first.
you just stepped on the bit, Rebecca. Come on.
Oh, sorry, Jeff. Yeah, let's go back and do another 12. But I think I should. I think I need to do some more like intentional thinking about what I read in that maybe like fresh out of college, middle of grad school phase of my life that I liked.
When you're just eating culture, you're just eating.
Yeah.
You're just jamming it in there.
I remember at the time being like, oh, this is special. Like Zadie Smith, this is a good book and it is special, and having that feeling. But I was not, I hadn't lived enough to really know why it was special to really get it in my bones in the way that I can get some of that stuff. Yeah. At this point, I think that's going to be a thing I'm going to think about for next year.
Two quick ones for me. I read Book Lovers by Emily Henry. Finally came up on my Libby hold and read that.
Tell me everything.
I enjoyed myself.
Okay.
I enjoyed myself. I would say it is qualitatively better than a recent book talk fave I've read.
Got it.
I think these books aren't for me, and that's okay. Not that people like me can't enjoy them, just that's not what I'm looking for. This one's pretty meta because the female lead is a book editor.
Okay.
And so is the male lead. And so they know all the romance tropes and romantic story tropes, and are sort of, and so does Emily Henry. She's clearly, I mean, not just a fan of romances, but a fan of tropes and metafiction books and publishing writ large. So that was fun to see. I guess this is going to sound terrible. I guess if I'm getting a romantic comedy or a romantic story, I really just want the very, very best. this is good, but I don't think, for me, it's just not sharp enough literarily. And there's so much playing with the tropes. And I'm like, oh, I don't really read this because of the tropes. And this is about having fun with the trope. So I'm guessing if you like romances and contemporary romances, you'll really like it. And I'm glad I read it. I would read her do some other stuff. I guess I'd be especially interested in reading an Emily Henry book that's not a romance. I don't really like knowing that they're for sure going to whatever at the end. Also, the steamy stuff, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm trying to flip through. Let's get to the dialogue. The dialogue's a lot of fun. but... Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad I read it. It was definitely, I can see why people like it. Would I read another one? Maybe. Maybe. I'm just not a category reader when it really comes down to it. I read another book called The Recruit by Alan Drew, which is a pretty category mystery with a little twist or thriller. It wasn't for me. Just, yeah, okay. If you like that, that's great. But, you know, I want to read formulaic business books. That's where my formulas lie. That's the only time I've got for formulaic. Oh, yeah, I know what is going to go on here. Business.
A books. History of business and 10 business books.
Yeah. The other one I recommended to you and Bob that I haven't talked about on the show, Wolf Hustle by Sin Fabre, which is, I've never listened to any book like this. I've never read a story like this. It's a memoir. Fabre grew up in a housing project in the Bronx, the child of Haitian immigrants. And she goes up through the ranks to become a stockbroker during the dot-com bubble is kind of where she is. She's about my age. She might be a little bit younger. And she narrates it and has a wonderful New York accent where there's no R's. It's all, if the Warriors are Warriors, coffee, dog. I love that. I miss that. I love that so much. And it is a very tough listen. I said to you after I recognized, like, oh, the first 90 minutes are a real tough hang. And the rest of it is not a whole lot better. A lot of family stuff, a lot of sexist stuff. Her little stock brokerage firm existed in the penumbra of shadow around Jordan Belfort's firm, which is the central figure in Wolf of Wall Street.
Wolf of Wall Street.
This is the kind of boiler room, over-the-counter stock trading probably should be illegal and maybe is now in most places. So you get that slice of life, how she got there. She basically was such a good salesperson at Cohen's Fashion Optical in a mall in Queens that she realized she could kind of sell anything, and someone recognized that and said, you should come be a cold caller for me. A cold caller, that's how she would say it in her New York accent. It was a really fascinating audiobook, and the kind of story, when we talk about diversifying stories, this is one that we don't get that many of these. Mm-mm. Like business memoirs in the trenches of Wall Street. I don't know if there's another one even exists by someone who's not white. I can't think of one, and I've read some of these. So that was really fascinating stuff. So anyway, there's that. It was.
I'm looking forward to that one.
All the trigger warnings, man. Just literally all of them.
Noted. And hearing you talk about Emily Henry is helpful because I haven't gotten to an Emily Henry yet, and my plan is to pick one to read on vacation this winter, like pick a beach book, go to the beach. So I'm probably not going to do book lovers because I don't want all that meta stuff. I think I'll pick one of the other. You're helping me narrow down my choices.
You're not a book for book lover kind of person, weirdly, which is a weird look for
makes
you.
Makes me
but
feel so pandered.
Oh, this book is about libraries. Yeah.
Speaking about books for book lovers, though, I think I'm going to go see The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey this weekend. So stay tuned for that.
It's in theaters?
Recap
that was
week.
A Netflix special. That's in theaters? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's coming out this week.
You're going to go see it, though, in a theater? Maybe I'm getting
I think so. Not because it's like a theater movie to me, but I've been taking myself to the movies like once a month. And
I do
the
like
thing
going
that's
to the
out.
Movies.
Going to the movies alone is like the best thing ever.
I ever told you
I'm
that my first year in New York when it was just me and all I was doing was studying on Friday nights, I would go to the movies, the Sony Lincoln Center at 66 and Broadway, and I'd just see something no matter what.
Yeah.
Every Friday.
That's great. Such a good vibe. That's what I'm trying to get into like once or twice a month. I used to do it before COVID. I'm really glad to have this back in my life. So I'm doing the like what's out and just going to see stuff.
That's our show this week. Show notes, podcast. No, bookriot.com/listen, email, podcast@bookriot.com. If you're on the Patreon, you've been circling, you've been wondering about it, You can go find us, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. Got more news and notes for you next week. I especially want to hear about your Nobel Prize feelings about Annie Ernaux. I'd also be curious, for those of you out there, do you ever, like, who amongst you has picked up a book because of the Nobel Prize, and what did you think of it? Our friend Greg picked up Afterlives. I saw him on Instagram say, why do I think it's going to be like homework? And I think he really captured something, even for me, who kind of likes homework, that I always, like, I'm doing this because it's now on the assigned canon reading list of life to some degree.
And it's like serious literature.
I'm never disappointed. I'm really never disappointed. I'm a snob. What am I worried about? This is for me. I'm going to be fine here. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.